No.
No.
Oh, yeah.
You're the friend.
So y'all comes out.
So y'all give a warm welcome.
Okay.
To Dan Fishman.
Thank you. Thank you guys very much for having me. So I have a little bit of a slideshow and no slide projector. So the slideshow is online. So if there's a smartphone, if you can go to tinyurl.com/LPMD2020. So start with tinyurl.com. That's the easy part. And then LPMD2020. Yep, slash after tinyurl.com/. And only has to be one person at each table. Somebody got it? LPMD 2020. Huh? tinyurl.com/LPMD2020. Yeah, forward slash. Oh. Yep. Didn't work for anybody yet. Yes, okay, good. I appreciate it. All right, so you guys will be getting there, all right? The first slide says persuasion versus coercion. The only argument you'll ever need. And this is derived from a talk that I actually heard recently where we talk about the different arguments that we use at various points in time. And libertarians, we all have our issue that we go to, something where we say, you know, this is the one thing that I use. And I get to talk about libertarianism. This is going to make a lot of sense. Like right now, I've been talking a lot about price gouging and how price gouging is actually a good thing in this scenario, right? If you are worried about the fact that, you know, there's a run on toilet paper, well, the best thing that you could do would be to charge $20 for a roll of toilet paper. Because at that point in time, somebody's going to say, I'm going to bring more toilet paper into the area where it's selling for $20, drive it from wherever here, wherever there is. We have a way that works out scarcity. That's a nice thing to talk about it. That's persuasion, right? People are persuaded to bring supplies into an area of scarcity. Coercion is actually the opposite. Coercion is when they say, nobody can buy more than two rolls of toilet paper. They make a law do that. When coercion happens, you get scarcity. You get empty shelves. And so when we see that right now, that's a great persuasion versus coercion argument. Which one is going to solve the problem? And persuasion is always the better method. And as libertarians, we know that because we don't want to get involved in coercion, using force. And coercion is always about using force. So now, we're going to go to the next slide. And who can tell me what that picture is of? D-Day. So it is a great relief to have that said here. The last time I showed that slide, I was speaking to a group of college students, and they said, that's Saving Private Ryan. As it turns out, Saving Private Ryan is actually based on a real event. I had the great good fortune to study in England for a year, and I took a class that was the history of World War II in 4 weeks, and each week was taught by a different professor from one of the Allied countries. So I knew the American version of World War II, how our economic might and essentially capitalism saved the world. Our ability to produce tanks and planes saved the world. The English version of World War II is a little bit different. How we hung on until the Americans finally got off their asses. But essentially, Churchill was the one who stopped a decrepit Roosevelt from giving away Eastern Europe to Stalin. The Russian version of World War II is very different. How the English and the Americans hoped that the Germans would kill us, but when they couldn't, they decided that they would help us at the end. And the French version is how we cunningly pretended to surrender to the Germans so that we could then sabotage them from behind their lines. It's always like that. The victors tell their own version of history. And we live in a political world where that happens as well. We are dealing with people who have been told different versions of American history to suit different political agendas. Republicans are telling their people, well, this is how all this stuff happened in America. And Democrats are telling people, this is how all this stuff happened in America. One of the things that I worry about that we are losing track of, and we're losing track of generationally, just show of hands. Does anybody here in this room have a friend who was drafted? They know somebody who was drafted? So a few. We still have somewhat of that memory. There is, on the next slide, a link to a page called virtualwall.org. And it shows all the Vietnam casualties by state. And if you go to that page and you scroll through just Baltimore, it is horrific. Maryland lost over 1,000 young men in Vietnam. And it was a draft. And I worry that we are losing that collective memory because Republicans and Democrats don't talk about that anymore. But at least for my generation, that is the greatest violation of our personal liberty that ever happened. Young men were taken from their homes, told that they had to go and join the military, sent overseas. And it wasn't a small thing. So the 60,000, roughly, American casualties in Vietnam, 2 million Americans served in Vietnam, in country, during the 10 years of our armed conflicts there. It is an enormous impact. People were taken against their will. And yet we have forgotten that part of our collective memory. And for us as libertarians, that's the thing that we have to watch out for, to make sure that that part of history isn't rewritten. That we remember that it wasn't about persuasion. And now, you know, when we talk about our armed forces and stuff like that, there's sort of a persuasion component that we have a volunteer army. But that volunteer army, it doesn't get to volunteer for the assignments that they get. They don't get to volunteer for where they're going. Coercion, which used to be what happened, right, when people were drafted, that was the worst thing the government's ever done. And the thing that people don't, that the government doesn't want you to remember is what made it stop. What made it stop is people like us in the streets protesting against the war, protesting against the draft. Government doesn't want you to remember that when we stand up together, we actually can change those things. We can make a difference in what's happening in our country. We can make a difference politically. Government is teaching us that we are politically powerless. When, let me quote a Democratic candidate from the cycle, Marianne Williamson, who said, it's not that we're afraid that we're powerless. We're afraid that we're powerful beyond our imagination. We still have that power. We have the power to change and redeem and to save our country. So, when I talk about saving, I want to talk about the next slide, which is, remember I talked about the fact that there were over 1,000 deaths in all of Vietnam, Maryland citizens. In 2017, 1,900 Marylanders were killed by opiates. Fact of the matter is that in states where you legalize medical, opiate deaths drop 25% the next year. And when you legalize recreational, the path continues. When we start advocating for cannabis legalization, decriminalization, we're not advocating for that because we want people to get high. I mean, if you do, that's okay with me. But we're advocating because it's salvation. We are saving people's lives when we're advocating for legalizing. Okay? We are saving lives from the fact that of the 50% of people who are in jail right now for nonviolent drug crimes, 40% of them are parents. Those are kids who are growing up without parents because of these ridiculous laws that we're putting into place that are hurting our country. As libertarians, when we talk about persuasion versus coercion, and we talk about the drug war, we can argue about drugs, we can argue about other things about it. That comes down to a persuasion versus coercion argument. And I will tell you, as a person who, in Massachusetts, and I have been a Marylander since November, but in Massachusetts, I could legally grow in my backyard. And we gave away plants. We would clone. And it was persuasion, right? Being able to give things away, what we found out is that actually, when people were able to grow, and when there was legal cannabis, cannabis use actually went down significantly in Massachusetts. And tell a little bit of a side story. So I have a friend who drives Uber in Boston. Boston is a... So when I say this to people in the DMV, they think I'm crazy, but your traffic here is nothing. Boston is terrible. It's so bad. And as a result, when you drive Uber in Massachusetts, it can be very lucrative. I have a friend who lives in Providence, goes up to Boston at 3 o'clock on Friday when it becomes surge, drives from 3 o'clock Friday till 2 o'clock Saturday morning. He would sleep in his car and start driving again at 10 o'clock Saturday morning till 2 o'clock Sunday morning, go home to Providence. Just driving those two, admittedly very long shifts, he made about $60,000 a year. And in Providence, your expenses aren't that high. So last winter, he said, you know what? Sleeping in my car is really cold, it's uncomfortable. I'm going to get a room and sleep in, but there's not a hotel room in Boston for under $250 a night. So he went to a storage place and got one of the small rooms and put down an air mattress and slept there in a sleeping bag, and it worked great. Worked great until after the fourth week, there's a knock on the door, and he rolls it up, and there's a police officer there. He's like, you can't sleep here. It's against the law. I'm writing you a ticket. And the ticket was for $1,000. And he called me. He's like, Dan, what can I do? I can't pay this $1,000. I'm like, go to court. Is it worth it to see what happens? At least if you go to court. You know, maybe you ask the judge for mercy. And so he gets his day in court, and he's talking to the judge, and he says, Your Honor, I didn't really know that I wasn't supposed to sleep there. And the judge says, you didn't know you were supposed to sleep there on the contract. There's signs. He's like, Your Honor, there was a sign out front that said self-storage. And the judge also laughed. And he said, I'm reducing your fine to $50. Don't do it again. And he didn't do it again. So that comes back to a whole thing about coercion and persuasion and one of the things that we believe in. Right, we believe in self-ownership. And you think about it, how stupid is a law saying that you can't rent a room when somebody's willing to rent it to you? So they guarantee you the storage places don't really care if they're renting out small little rooms at $60. The people who care are the people who are protected by government, right? The hotel business, they get these big licenses, and they maintain the $250 a night rule. Now, if somebody wanted to say, I don't want people sleeping in this area of private property, of course, we'd be like, yeah, it's totally fine. On the other hand, if you want to have little micro hotels and stuff like that, self-ownership, we're in favor of that sort of thing. Persuasion versus coercion. The market will take care of that stuff if we'll let it. And we're an example of, you know, one of the greatest examples of where the market has been thwarted. Everything that's gone wrong right now with Corona, you guys know the story, right? That just south of here in North Carolina is where they make the test that China's been using for the last 8 weeks. But we can't get that test in the United States until supposedly yesterday the president allowed us to use a test that's made in North Carolina. But that company's capable of cranking them out for China. Why? Because the FDA and the CDC were having a squabble, and they wanted to benefit the companies that have benefited them. And this company in North Carolina, even though it's a biotech company, they weren't politically favored. They weren't blessed. They hadn't given enough to the right people for them to be the solution. And so what happens is Americans are actually suffering. We actually have no idea right now how bad Corona really is in the country because we don't have adequate testing. You guys see anybody see the lines yesterday at the airports coming in? Yeah, astonishing. I mean, that Americans are being held in a scenario like that is really depressing. But there are giant lines. It took about 6 hours for people to get in through O'Hare. In fact, they were recommending that people fly to Canada and rent a car and drive into the United States because it would be better than having to fly in the United States right now. Those sort of impositions on our personal liberty don't have to happen if we have persuasion, if we have the free market filling the need, the scarcity. When you have coercion and a law that says, no, the law says you cannot do this, that's where we break these things, and that's where we break our stuff. So the next slide has that quote at the top, après moi le déluge. Who knows who said it? Almost always wrong. It is, so it's actually before the French Revolution, but you're right, it's Louis XIV, Louis XIV, because he knew the revolution's coming. He's like, my kids, they're not going to be able to hold this back anymore. There's a story, so you know, I told you I went to school in England for a year. Another fascinating story that I was told while I was there, or another fascinating class that I took, was we studied the history of the French Revolution only reading primary documents. So we didn't read anybody's commentary on the French Revolution. We just read the newspapers of the day in Paris. And in Paris, there were four main newspapers. There was the tradesman's paper, which is sort of the Wall Street Journal of the day of Paris. There was the clerical paper, which was sort of the church newspaper. The church had a lot to do. There was the people's newspaper, which was a lot of gossip and shopping articles, etc. And then there was the royalist newspaper that was read by the nobles. And the day after the peasants stormed the Bastille and set loose all the political prisoners and burned down the prison, the people's newspaper said, "Joyous day as families reunited, political prisoners freed." And the clerical newspaper talked about lots of wounded at the Bastille Square. Church offers a lot of medical help. And the business newspaper said, "Huge traffic jam at the Bastille. Fish rots on carts while being delivered to market." And the royalist paper said, "The king went falconing." Even back in 1789, there is no such thing as a reliable media. The media is telling people the stories that they know their audience wants to hear. And so for us as libertarians, right, when we're not talking about a political agenda, we're talking about liberty, and liberty being individual, we're seeing something that's different. We're seeing people that are hearing all these different messages. I was having a conversation with David. Go ahead and skip ahead to the next slide. And it was incredible that we had this conversation because he said how Happy Days was a unifying experience for our generation. And I'm not saying you're as old as me, David, but there was a point in time when there were only three television networks. There was a point in time where if you watched the TV news, you watched David Brinkley or you watched Walter Cronkite. That doesn't happen anymore. We don't have that unifying experience of shared commonality. That's probably the most popular television show in recent memory is Game of Thrones. How many people here would say they watched every episode of Game of Thrones? Maybe a quarter of the room. Okay, and that's the most popular common social event. Sports, right? People watch Super Bowl, people watch World Series. How many people watch the Nationals win the World Series? Wow, Baltimore, y'all are cold. But we don't have that shared experience anymore because people have the ability to pursue their own media and pursue the story that they want to hear. And if we think it's going to get better, we're deluding ourselves. The idea that people are actually going to come out and perceive the same truth and perceive the same description of what's actually happening in our world. When we talk about what's happening, we need to understand that everybody has a different perception. And so now on to the next slide. And this is one that you kind of want to show people a little bit. Share it around the table. Because it says big tents, little tents, in tents, and then has a list of things that libertarians hate. Right? Number one thing, or we have Republicans at 11% and Democrats at 9% and Rhodes at 19%. And, those fucking Rhodes. And, of course, other libertarians. When we talk about tents, right, and the idea of a big tent party, we are missing what libertarianism is actually all about. Okay? Because tent means that people have to come into your tent. If you believe in big tents or little tents, that's not libertarian. If you believe that everybody ought to be able to look up and see the stars in the sky, that's libertarianism. And that's the thing about it, is that we all see something else. When we talk about looking at the stars, right, I see Sirius the dog star, right? Somebody else sees a cow. Somebody else sees aliens finally coming to take them home. Whatever you see up in the sky, that's your perception of it. We color the world through our own perception. And the libertarian message is the only one that says everybody gets that. everybody gets that right to have their perception of the world, as long as you're not coloring anybody else's. And we can talk about it, but I don't get to tell you, oh yeah, that actually is Sirius the Dog Star, and he's following his master Orion across the sky, and then there's the Scorpion on the other side, and that's what we decided all the stars look like. Libertarians are the only ones who say, make up your own story. Make what makes you happy. And as we live in this world of divergent media and divergent messaging, when we tell people we're never going to have this common agreement and we shouldn't, it's starting to resonate now. As people see this varying views of what's happening, that's the thing that gets us from point A to point B. When we start talking about the fact we shouldn't be telling people what they see in the stars. We shouldn't be telling people they have to come into our tent. We're the only ones who have a message that is larger than everything else because it's smaller than everything else, right? Ayn Rand said, the individual, the ultimate minority. It's true, right? We are all fundamentally minorities of one. So I occasionally get up in a tie and I look like I can speak, but in reality, I'm Dan, the kid who played Dungeons and Dragons, but loved musical theater, and played lacrosse, but might still have some Magic the Gathering cards in the trunk somewhere. I'm a weird dude, okay? In any other country, I would probably be in jail, because it is not in my nature to submit to authority. This is the only country where I don't have to, right? Where I get to do 80% of what I want. I want it to be better. And a lot of times people will talk to me, and libertarians, we get this message a lot, where we tell people, don't you want to be free? And most people say, I am free. Right? Because they don't understand that they're not. But for me, we do live in the freest country in the world. But I don't want to be freest. I want to be free. And that's a distinction that we need to make to a lot of people. It's in our bones to want to be free. You go to the next slide. One of our documents that we don't talk about a lot, but really is a founding document, the Mayflower Compact, right? Pilgrims on the Mayflower, we tell a story, and I don't know how much we talk about this in other places, how much you talk about it. All right, so this, you guys will laugh at this one. So when I moved here from Boston, I thought, you know, Boston is a great place filled with all this amazing history. I don't think they have any history in Virginia and Maryland. I didn't know. I didn't even think about it. We're so Boston-centric. We're the only ones who had the Revolution, or, you know, people come over. And now, Jamestown, of course, is the oldest continuous settlement, sort of. Does anybody know what the actual oldest settlement from Europe is that's continuously settled in the United States? St. Augustine. Yes, is exactly right. 1519 St. Augustine settled, but in Massachusetts, we always say, well, Pilgrims are the real first one, but they did have that thing down in Jamestown in 1607. Mayflower Compact, though, they were actually sailing to Virginia. They got a little bit lost, a little weather, whatever it is. They stop up in Provincetown, and they say, before we go any further, we're lost. We're not going to make it to Virginia. We don't know exactly what's going on, but it's going to be tougher than just Virginia. We need to bind ourselves together voluntarily to this idea that we are going to go and establish this colony, this Plymouth plantation. They didn't know it was Plymouth at the time. And they did, and they signed, and they agreed that we are going to voluntarily bind ourselves together. And there's this myth that it was just people seeking religious freedom, but it's not, actually. There were some people who were just coming over to work. So we have these religious people and these non-religious people, and they agree to bind themselves together. And as we proceed further into American history, we look at one of our most amazing accomplishments compared to other countries. I'm going on to the next slide. We have almost perfect religious tolerance in the United States, right? Christians and Jews and Sikhs and Hindus and Muslims and other religions that I can't think of right now. We all fundamentally live together in harmony. And at no point in time do Catholics think, if we win an election, everybody has to go to Mass on Sunday, the whole country. Because we don't think that we would impose religious laws on each other. Jews don't think, if we win an election, every Friday night, everybody has to celebrate the Sabbath. It's crazy, right? The idea that we would impose one religious view on another. And you say that to any American, they're like, yeah, of course. Of course not. They say, well, then why, when Democrats win an election, do they expect everybody to follow the Democratic rules? Or when Republicans win an election, they expect everybody to follow the Republican rules? We have this idea inherently in our character of tolerance, the idea that people get to do what they want to do. And we certainly think of it in a religious sense, but politics, we don't apply that to. And where do we lose that message? And I'll tell you, it's pretty simple to think about why it's happened, right? The political parties want us to think that's what elections mean. And when you win an election, you get to tell everybody else what to do, right? It's democracy, right? How can you be undemocratic, right? How can you oppose democracy? Do you like communism? You don't like democracy? Of course not. All right, Alexis de Tocqueville comes over, Democracy in America, and talks about a tyranny of the democracy. A tyrant is a tyrant is a tyrant. Even if it means 51% of the people saying that the other 49% have to be slaves. Or if it means 70% of the people saying that 10% of the people have to pay 90% of the tax income. Whatever is the iteration, a tyrant is a tyrant is a tyrant. There's this word that the Democrats use, intersectionality. Okay? And they say, oh, that's how we bind everybody together because we all have these little things that bind us together and you have to suppress all of your goals because we have this one set of intersections and so we should work together politically. Libertarians should own the word intersectionality because everybody has a feeling, everybody has an incident where the government has imposed its will upon them when we have had to put our neck down for the government. And everybody has that. That's the intersectionality that we should be embracing. And what we need to do is to find that intersectionality. And when we meet that person who's had that part where government has put their boot on their neck, we say, I've been there. I've been there. We don't say, now you have to support decriminalization of all drugs, or else I can't help you. We don't tell them that unless you think taxation is theft, I'm not going to help you. We say, I get it. I get the fact that government is ruining your life and this thing. And that's the thing that should be binding us together. Persuasion versus coercion. And what are we representing when we have these lines that we tell people they have to meet? Are we advocating for persuasion? Or are we advocating for coercion? We should try to be as persuasive as possible when we meet these people who should be our allies. And it's important that we have allies. So we go on to the next slide. This is one that the kids in college get, but they still think it's a movie. It's a picture of the Titanic sinking. And there's a story that I heard the other day. Jim and I were in Reno, and the speaker there told us about it. Imagine if you're in a lifeboat, and the Titanic is sinking, and 17 of you, and 9 of you are convinced the land is that way, and 8 of you are convinced that land is that way. If you can't agree, and everybody just rows, we'll assume everybody rows at one unit, got 9 going this way, 8 going that way, you're going to go one unit this way an hour, right? So in 3 hours, you'll have gone 3 miles. If you, as the 9 people, can just somehow persuade those 8 people, don't work against us. Sit back and let us row for 1 hour, and then if we don't see anything, we'll turn around and we'll go your way. You will have gone 9 miles that way. If you can stop the 8 people from working against you, you'll get there. If you can persuade them to row with you, right, you're going to go 17 miles that direction. And you just say, look, let's have a persuasive argument where we agree if we can go 17 miles this way and then turn around and go 2 hours and go 34 miles that way, we'll have gone much further working together than we ever could if we were resisting each other, if you were pulling that way and I was pulling this way. And as libertarians, there are times that we have to recognize the people who are actually our allies, who want to go the same direction as us, or who are willing to help out and go that direction. Now, we're on a train. We're all going in the same direction. Some of us are getting off a few stops before the others. Libertarians at times say, okay, we get everybody into the train. We know that some people are getting off. Let's have a fight in the bar car before we go anywhere else. We can't do that because the stakes are really too high now. Okay? We are in the last throes of the idea that our founders gave to us of a country dedicated to the proposition, right, of a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. Does anybody think that's really true now? No, I don't either, and it's sad. Is it too far gone? Are we the best chance to get it back? We are. One of the speeches that I think they don't teach enough is Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. And I know Lincoln's controversial here in Maryland, but dedicated to the proposition that a government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not vanish from this earth. That is a noble idea. And that is what we are dedicated to, the idea of a government based in liberty, right, conceived in liberty, and based on the idea that all of us are created equally. And we can't lose in that respect. So that's the sort of thing that brings us all together. And I want to talk about a few topics that are things that we can talk about that actually make a lot of sense. So if you go on to the next slide, excuse me, I swear I don't have corona. I have a chronic cough. One of the things that I like to say to people sometimes when I'm meeting people who want to know who libertarians are, I say, well, we are the party that is tough on crime. We, in fact, are the toughest on crime. You'll hear Republicans say they're tough on crime. Democrats say they're tough on crime. But really, libertarians are the ones who are tough on crime. They're like, what are you talking about? I hear you guys say you want to legalize sex work and you want to decriminalize all drugs and stuff like that. I'm like, well, how can you be any tougher on crime than wanting to get rid of criminals? And the easiest way to get rid of criminals is to get rid of stupid laws. And we know that there are stupid laws everywhere. We know that there are people being arrested, being separated from their families. We know that justice is money. Justice is status. Justice is not justice anymore. And if you've seen it, you'll never forget it. Now, I remember watching, and I've talked to some of you about this before, so people who were at the Anne Arundel meeting, I apologize for hearing this again, but Eric Garner, right? Eric Garner was a hustler. I don't want to make it seem like he was a saint. Eric Garner was a guy who lived in New York City, and he went out and he did what he did to make money. Some days it was a deal here. Some days it was an odd job there. Might have been legal, might not. Every day when he came home, he would go to the bodega below where he lived. He would buy a pack of cigarettes, and he would come out and he would sell them loose, $1 each. Now, I don't know how much cigarettes cost now, but at the time, it was $14 for a pack of cigarettes in New York City. He would sell them for $1 each, and he would make $6. He would go back into the bodega, and he would buy a chicken or hamburger or whatever and go upstairs to his 6 kids and make dinner. A couple times the police had stopped him. They're like, hey, you can't do that. You know, you can't sell loose cigarettes. And he made the argument, I could give away loose cigarettes. How many people here have ever bummed a cigarette from somebody else? That's a small number. That's a good change of where we are. But I can tell you, as a former smoker, it was a very common occurrence. You can, of course, give a cigarette to somebody who wants to bum a cigarette from you. That couldn't be illegal. But somehow the act of that person saying, let me give you $1, that makes it illegal? Or me asking for $1? So the third time this happened, the police came by. And I said, we're going to arrest you. And Eric said, guys, I got kids upstairs. I here's the money. Here's the cigarettes. We won't have this problem anymore. Can we just talk about it? And they're like, we're arresting you. You're coming down here. So like, I can't be arrested. And he's backing away. And there's a police officer behind him. And he came up and he put him into a chokehold. And they took him down to the ground. Eric Garner's a large man. As they take him down to the ground, he says, I can't breathe. I can't breathe. And they say, and this is all on video, they say, if you can talk, you can breathe. And then he stopped talking. And then he stopped breathing. And then he was dead. Why? Because of a stupid law that says you can't sell a cigarette that you already bought, that you paid for, that's yours, that you own? How can it be illegal to sell something that you could give away for free? persuasion versus coercion. Is that something we should have used coercion for, that we should have used force for? And we say, oh, yeah, I didn't do it. We did that. We own a piece of that. Because through our political inactivity or our political activity or whatever, our collective society is supporting laws like that. And we have to fight against them because we're the only ones who are right now. But it is getting better. Okay, you guys, the new members of the Libertarian Party, right? You saw the magic thing. I'm sweeping the card. It used to be that it was completely illegal for anybody except for somebody who had a taxi medallion to drive somebody from point A to point B. Even though, right, again, that's something you could do for free. I back in the day, I made a lot of airport runs for my friends. I would drive them to the airport and drop them off because it's much better to get dropped off and walk in. Nobody does that anymore. Even your friends don't ask you to take them to the airport because you got Uber, you got rideshare, something like that that comes in and makes a big difference. Persuasion, right? Once people saw that that was a better way, then it became legal. Okay? The coercion of the government trying to control the taxi market, that goes away. Now, I'm seeing the government trying to fight back, forces of coercion trying to fight back. I just flew into LAX a little while ago. Uber can't pick you up at the airport anymore. You actually have to take a bus somewhere else, then you have to walk past 200 taxi cabs to get to where you can get Uber. I don't know how it's going to get resolved. It's, you know, it's a constant battle, armor and warhead, right? We come up with an innovation, they come up with a way to protect the businesses that are protected by government. I believe that innovation will win, but it won't win if we don't keep fighting. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about us as libertarians and how we make a difference. We make a difference by libertarians getting elected. And that sounds like something that's far-fetched, but it's not. There are 192 elected libertarians across the country, 13 elected libertarian mayors. Getting a libertarian elected at the local level makes a big difference. We're lucky enough to have a couple presidential candidates in the room, too. Those guys are sacrificing. Please find a way to get a chance to talk to them about their experience on the campaign trail. But one of the things that I want to talk about is the way that we run as libertarians. If I were a baker and I wanted to open up a bakery, I would not just open up a bakery right away. I would start off by baking cakes for my neighbors, brownies for bake sales, something to get a feel that I knew I could actually be a good baker. That may come up. If I were going to be an IT guy, right? I would be able to fix my own computer. I would be the guy that people came to with, I can't print on my, or I can't set up my home network, something like that. I would have experience doing that before I decided to open up a storefront where I said, okay, I can be an IT guy. But libertarians, when we run for office, we're like, I'm going to start off as a candidate. I'm the guy who can be the candidate who can run for office. When in reality, running for office is a process. Winning an election is a process. And we need people who are involved in the process, in the business of elections. I know that sounds like a terrible thing to say because Americans are, you know, elections aren't a business. They're a business process. Okay? We're not running a business to make a profit or anything like that. But the functionality of getting from point A to point B where somebody gets elected, that's something that we understand how to do. It's about moving the point from point A to point B. And we need people who understand the process. And you understand the process by getting involved in elections. So right now we got a couple presidential candidates in the room. I don't know who the nominee is going to be, but they're going to need people in Maryland. Okay? We're going to have candidates running statewide. David, when you ran, how large was your campaign staff?
You're looking at it.
It's good, but I don't want to laugh at that. Okay? I did the same thing. I ran for Congress in 2012. And the stupidest thing I ever did was fund my own campaign. Because I told people, my campaign is so unimportant that I don't need you to invest in it. But if we're invested in these ideas, we have to be invested in our campaigns and our candidates. And that means either money or time or both. I can tell you that for a congressional candidate, for any candidate, when a candidate goes somewhere, if they show up as a loner, You can replace that N with an S. They look like a loser. Can you be the person who makes sure that the Libertarian candidates in Maryland don't have to go to an event by themselves? That's not a lot to ask, right? One event. Every person in the room does one event with a candidate, so they're not there by themselves. Because the other thing about it is, unless you run for office, and Dave, I don't know if your experience was the same as mine, but there are times that I went into rooms and I felt lonely. I mean, I'm like, how am I here by myself? Because it's tough. The things that we're talking about, we're talking to people about tearing up some of the stuff that they believe is sacred. The idea that government is going to protect them, right? The idea that, yes, David.
Let me build on that. Encourage people to help, right? Which is, I think what I'm so far in God's presence, God helps me. I can remember a few people just forward when they did and what they did, and it really meant something. So if you just step up and help at the one event, it really helps the candidate keep going, to feel like somebody believes in them.
And
a little step forward can make a big difference.
And that's it. And the thing that we're talking about, is it life or death? I talk about Vietnam, right? I talk about opiate deaths. I talk about the difference that, right now, a libertarian policy would have made in terms of corona testing. Every little thing that we can do, every conversation that we can have, when we support ourselves, we make our movement better. And the stakes are too high for us to fail. Now I'm going to move into talking a little bit more about the party, national party, tying it into all this stuff. And so on the next slide, and this one's going to be tough because it's numbers. But last year, 2019, the party grew faster than it has in any non-presidential year in a long time. We ended with the largest number of members that we've had in any non-presidential year since 2005. That's something that's worth sharing. And you guys, Maryland has done a lot for that. Looking at that chart, if you guys look over in the right-hand column, R1, and I'm sorry to put you on small screens, the number of people who stay with us after 1 year is under 50%. And usually it averages out around 40%. Tyler Harris helped me with some of those really tough numbers. That's an important thing. Because the number of people who stay with us after the first year, the number of people who stay with us in the second year, is 75%. So if we can get you to stay 1 year, you're going to be with us for a long time. And the reason why that makes a difference is you go back and look at the years where we've brought a lot of people in, and the best example of that is 2016 on the chart. 2016, there were 10,000 new members of the Libertarian Party. And even though a lot of those people didn't stay, in fact, only 36% of them stayed after the first year. All the people who came in, the class of 2016, is still 19% of the party. Because after we got those people who might not have been what we were thought of as great libertarians, they came in through candidates who you may or may not have liked in 2016. But in the second year, the people who we got past the first year, they stayed at the same rate, 75%. There's this phrase, and tell me if you've ever heard it, the libertarian macho flash. Okay? This is this idea that you meet somebody else and you're going to shock them with the most shocking thing you can say about libertarianism. Okay? We support, I don't know, I don't even want to say the most shocking thing I can say about libertarianism. So, you guys imagine it. Recreational cocaine is good. That's milder than other things that I was going to say. But once people get used to us and say, you know what, that's just something that some people do, that libertarian macho flash, they stick with us. Because, right, the best thing about a libertarian convention is other libertarians. You get to hang out with each other. We have this sense of belonging to each other. What we talked about in the Mayflower Contract, that we are voluntarily bound to ourselves, that we willingly accept this challenge to make sure that a government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not vanish from the earth. We are the ones who are left. We are given this sacred task. And we have more people than ever coming into the party right now. It's going to be a presidential year, and even more people are going to come in. So the burden is on every person in this room to make sure that those people feel welcome. I want to change that 40% that stay in the first year. If we can just change it to 50%, we increase the size of the party. If we can get it over 50%, we're really winning. And so that means when you sign somebody, who here, this is their first Libertarian Party of Maryland convention. Look at it. Everybody needs to find one of these people, say hi, welcome. My name is Dan. I'm a libertarian. That's where we go. That's where we win. And so I'm kind of running to the end. I'm out of slides. That usually means I'm done. I am out of slides. No, I'm not. Darn it. All right, yeah, so the active donors. The next slide goes to what I was talking about. Party size is increasing. And then the final thing about it, ballot access. And so here I want to tell you a little party news, and then I'm the executive director. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have. We are suspending petitioning across the country. We are suspending our professional petitioners. That doesn't mean if there's somebody in this room who wants you to sign up, and that doesn't mean I don't want you to gather individual signatures, but having been out with the petitioners, right now, if you go up to somebody in Maryland and say, please touch my pen and sign this piece of paper, they're not happy about that. And that's a very reasonable fear right now. It's not just us that's having this problem. Republicans and Democrats as well. In fact, Democrats in New York are currently petitioning their government to get rid of their state government to get rid of their signature requirements this year. They're going to get it because New York's a Democratic state. We're probably going to get on top of that as well. But one of the other reasons that I want to tell you this is because we have petitioners who are in New Mexico who are now presumptive positives for the coronavirus. In our community, our small little community, there is corona. I was not in New Mexico. I don't want to scare you. Maybe I want to scare you a little bit. Because going back to what I said, we're all we got. Okay, we can't afford to endanger our community. We can't afford to risk things. So please, I used to work at a hospital in Boston, and we practiced what's called universal precautions, where we assumed that everything was infectious. Treat everything, every person, with a great deal of respect. Don't be scared to say hi to people and stuff like that. But think about the fact that we're the ones who are going to bring forward the Liberty Revolution. How much do we want to risk that through? Let's do a handshake. If you want to do a handshake, I'm not going to tell you not to, right? You're libertarians. But I want you to think about the non-aggression principle and the fact that you might actually be infected right now and you don't know it. Does anybody here have a friend who went to CPAC? Couples. All right? Right? There's active infection at CPAC. Anybody here have a kid in a school that's closing soon? Yep. Right. We don't know whether or not we're infected. And so our responsibility to each other is to make sure that we practice the non-aggression principle. In the same way that there are times that I say, you know what? I'm not driving right now. Not because I think I'm going to be in an accident or anything like that, but because I think I'm too impaired to drive safely. I'm not really worried about killing myself. I don't want to kill somebody else. What we're talking about now in terms of taking care of ourselves and our community is the same sort of thing. So the closing statement I have, I truly believe that libertarianism is the political expression of loving your neighbor. Because if you don't love other people, you don't care about their freedom, right? You care about yourself. You love yourself, you're interested in your own freedom. To want other people to have the same liberty that you do, that is loving your neighbor. Let's have this idea that we really love each other and we matter to each other. Let's share it, because it is contagious. And that's the good sort of contagion that we want, right? The idea that we all want this freedom, we want other people to have it. And to that end, I'd be happy to answer any questions you guys have. You're cutting into Bob's question time.
I want you to know that I would be happy to show for any and all of your events on your 2022 campaign.
Unlikely to run for governor of Maryland. Thank you. Does Maryland have a residency requirement for governor?
Yeah.
All right. Yes, sir.
So my question is about something I read, I think, in ballot access, that the nationally, in states that have registrations by party, our registrations are way
up. Yep.
Is there an explanation for this?
A lot of it has to do with the fact that we ran good campaigns. So, let's see, how can I say this without, this might sound a little arrogant, you'll just have to forgive me. 2018, I ran for auditor in Massachusetts. It actually was a ballot access race. I'm not saying I ran just for ballot access, but I ran the best campaign I could. And I learned the stuff that I was talking about. So, right, 2012, I ran for Congress. I financed my own campaign. 2018, when I ran for auditor, we got together in the middle of 2017 and said, let's build a staff. Let's raise money now. And if we can't raise $5,000, you're not the candidate to run for auditor, and we're going to find somebody else to do it. So we did all that, and we got to that point. We announced in October of 2017. We got good press, and we built a team. Some of you probably know Jeff Lyons because, geez, that guy gets around. Jeff Lyons was my campaign manager. Chris Crawford was my treasurer. I had a youth director. I had a social media manager. We built a real team, and we ran a great campaign. And did we win? We didn't win. I did manage to get endorsed by every paper in Massachusetts because we were a real campaign. And we were out there, and we were talking about stuff. So Massachusetts, registration, where we have registration by party, Massachusetts registration is up 131% since 2018. That's from having a good campaign. And we have been running good libertarian campaigns across the country. But we need to do more. And that's the biggest thing about it. I don't know when you guys were a major party, right? 2 years ago? How many registered Maryland voters were there? So that's awesome. So about half of 1% of the state? All right. So, I mean, that's a good place to be starting from. I am convinced that we will get back there very quickly. Presidential race doesn't count, right? It has to be the governor's race in 2022?
Correct.
All right. So we'll get there. I'm not the guy you want for candidate. I'm going to be doing other stuff. But I will commit to making sure that our gubernatorial campaign is as competitive as we can possibly make it. And we'll get that 1% back. And I think that when we do, we will see the number of libertarians increase dramatically. Our ideas are winning whenever we get the chance to put them out there well. And there is nothing as good as a campaign for spreading the ideas of libertarianism. And we can talk all we want, but good candidates make an enormous difference. In the small town that I lived in Massachusetts, just north of Boston, I had just finished my congressional campaign, and I'm done with politics. I'm never going to run again. And a friend of mine who runs a restaurant in Boston calls me up. Runs a restaurant in Beverly. He calls me up and says, hey, Dan, they just passed this crazy law in Beverly where you can't use an out-of-state driver's license for a form of identification. Only a Massachusetts driver's license or a passport is valid for an identification to buy alcohol. It actually is. There's like 30 towns in Massachusetts that have passed that law. And I'm like, how did this happen? He's like, well, a couple kids from Endicott, the local college, came in with a really good fake ID, bought booze, went back and trashed the college. The college complained to Beverly. Beverly responded with these laws. I just had to turn away a U.S. soldier in uniform with his military ID and his Virginia driver's license, both of which he said he was 25 years old, and I couldn't give that soldier a beer. I'm like, what do you want me to do? He's like, I don't know. What can you do? I'm like, well, there's a city council election coming up. I can run for office. I can talk about this one thing. I was never going to win a city council race, right? I didn't grow up in Beverly. My kids didn't play soccer with anybody else's kids, anything like that. That's what city council is about. But I talked about that one issue. And before the primary, because I kept talking about it every place I went to, they changed the law. Because when people talk and we elevate our voices by running for office and running good campaigns. I wasn't running a joke campaign. I mean, I went around to places. I spoke to people all the time. I talked about other issues. But I always hammered home the point of the liquor laws. Now, when the primary came, right, there was five of us running for to be eliminated to two. And I'd done a lot of door knocking and had some signs up. And I saw a person driving away who, I'm like, I was at that person's house twice. They're going to vote for me. I waved at them. They said, oh, you know, I'm really sorry I couldn't vote for you. I'm like, I thought you had a sign up for me. You know, when I found out that you wanted to destroy all the schools, then I didn't. So that's right. That's right. That's part of where we are, right? We have this mixed messaging. Okay, and at no point in time had I even talked about schools, obviously. It just wasn't something I was going to talk about. So I won the original thing, and I didn't win the election. And sometimes you can win the cause that you want to fight for without winning the election. There's a couple of really good examples of that in the United States. Right, the temperance movement never won an election. Well, somehow they got prohibition passed. Right? That's insane. But by just talking about the issue. Okay, those are people we don't like. The socialists, right? The National Workers Party. We don't like them either. They never won an election. But they got the National Labor Relations Board Act passed. Okay, by campaigning and running. I want us to win elections. I want people to get elected. But when we run good races, we move the window and we get people talking about stuff. So I think that's why we see registration up, a number of libertarians across the country up, because we've been running good races and we need to run more. Yes, sir.
Starting with your example of Uber versus Cabify, Uber offers a competitive alternative to taxicab. So people might never want to take taxi because they felt it was not a value with Uber. So in going to now, what are things? When I talk to, I want people who did not vote or don't even consider voting, you know, which is around 50%. That's the person I want to try to talk to. Come show up and vote. Not many people who will show up because usually they have an act, well, not act, they want to protect their, you know, insurance government issues like funding schools, even a bad school, going to settle each other, physical stuff. So how are we,
It's a really good question. Voting is habitual. And I've heard a lot of candidates come along and say, I'm going to get the people who don't vote to come vote for me. That doesn't happen. What you can do is hopefully you can get people to vote for the first time when they're young, maybe. But you know how they say young people don't vote? It's just true. They don't. And I apologize to the young people in the room. But as a group, hasn't been a lot of, you know, there's not a lot of voting at that point in time. But there are a lot of people who have voted for different party candidates at various points in time. I don't know a lot. We're using the Maryland voter file for validation of the signatures that we gathered in state. And one of the things that we don't have, and I don't know if this is available or not, but a voter activity file. So Massachusetts, because we have primaries, I can get the records of everybody who voted and which party they voted for in the primary. So we built lists of all the people who had voted in both a Republican and a Democratic primary over the last 20 years. So at one point in time they voted Democrat, another point in time they voted Republican. And we started targeting those people. And in fact, I sent a postcard, my campaign sent a postcard to 5,000 of them right before the Libertarian primary. And we got a higher turnout in the primary, even though I was the only candidate on there, than we'd ever gotten in a Libertarian primary at that point in time. Finding the people who have shown to at least be a little bit open-minded. And I can't remember who said it, but somebody said the definition of an intellectual is somebody who has the ability to change their mind. Those are the people that we have to look for. Now, trying to get the people who don't vote to vote, we got to do that because it's such a large number, right? I mean, even if you could only get 1 out of 1,000 of those people to do that, that's still a significant number. But your money is not super well spent in that case. We want to be doing outreach, but we have to find a way to galvanize a generation of people who believe, I'm going to sit at home. Government's going to take care of me. Getting those people to act is one of the most difficult political tasks there. I want to do it, but I think that there is lower hanging fruit for us. And so I'm sorry that's not the great answer. I don't have a great answer how to get the people who don't vote to vote. That is the That's the mystery question that every candidate would like to know, and I don't have a great answer for it. I've probably gone too long. Okay, good. Well, I'm glad. So thank you guys very much, and I am so happy to be a member of the Libertarian Party of Maryland. Thanks, guys.